This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Good. How are you doing, Jen?
Pretty good. How's it going? Yeah.
Okay, that's enough small talk, for God's sake.
Yeah. Yeah, boy. It's,
yeah.
It's nice to see you making an effort.
Now we're doing the small talk, right?
You guys.
God. One thing at a time, Dr. Hawk. Don't worry. We'll get it right.
Oh, my.
Well,
when you
for
said
everyone
four,
playing
four
along
play
at
the
home
other week, Jen, I just cracked up. It's like, it's a Jen Hawk special to pull that out of there. That's just beautiful.
That's what it is. I gotta just jump right into the podcast. Gotta warm people up.
She's insinuating about our skills or lack thereof.
I leave the people to draw their own conclusions.
Can we blame the lockdown on that?
God, that's good. Oh, anything. God. Yeah.
Well, speaking of lockdown, is there any news in the coronavirus front?
Boy,
any of you have heard?
Yeah. What's up with your thinking, Jen?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's news on the coronavirus per se front, but there's a lot of, as we're recording this, for this week's podcast, a couple days before it airs, there's a lot of discussion going on about what look like very actual active plans to put something resembling a vaccine passport into place at the, sort of a government mandated, government organized. You've got a little app on your phone that, you're able to flash at all sorts of different businesses and airports and everything else in a really synchronized system to let all kinds of merchants know if you're vaccinated or not. So this is something that, a year ago would have been a really far-fetched idea that people from all across the political spectrum would be horrified by. But we're in the, politics in the time of Corona where it's all upside down and you're having sort of the partisan lines being drawn around this where a lot of people that I would not expect to be supportive of such an idea are very supportive of the idea and vice versa. So I certainly don't consider myself a full-blown libertarian at all, not even as far in that direction as you are, Doug, but sure. I mean, the idea of a government-mandated vaccine passport that aggregates all of the personal data, not only our health data, but, all of the other information that exists about us on all of the apps on our phone and all of the ways that information is already being shared. People have heard me rant at length about data analytics and how we're already being manipulated in so many ways by all of our data and all of our comings and goings on the internet and everything else. And I'm very skeptical of any claim that this would be of limited scope to only cover vaccine information and would be sufficiently protected and unhackable even if it were limited to that and not to other health information at a minimum, let alone everything else that you could see people making a case to integrate with this kind of system. So this is like the slipperiest of slippery slopes.
Yeah.
and it's just gives me great angst to think about where this could go. And what's amazing to me is it's like the same people who are advocating for this are, you know, if this were promoted by a Republican government, as things like, I mean, I'm old enough to remember, you know, the people rioting in the streets over the privacy intrusions of the Patriot Act in the wake of 9/11, and the idea that we would have dossiers of who you'd been in contact with and what books you'd checked out from the library and you know, what you were spending your money on, and that the government would be tracking that kind of information had leftists out in force. And so now you have the tables turned because we're in this very different political context. And I'm just wondering, where has the high concept gone? Where has, you know, civil liberties and the protection of personal privacy gone? In, you know, it's a very comparable case, because with the Patriot Act, that was also on the, you know, it was justified behind kind of emergency powers, and the suspension of rule of law was justifiable. People were willing to make some trade-offs in their personal civil liberties to feel safer, and we're in exactly that same context now. But the political fault lines have been drawn entirely differently based on who's in power. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to watch it. I'd be very interested in hearing your libertarian take on it.
Yeah, I have such a variety of perspectives on that, and that is that I don't often, or at least for not a very long length of time, maybe an hour or two at most, I don't often lose perspective about where we are in history and how it is that we live here in the United States. So the United States was vastly less free in terms of your ability to express yourself under Woodrow Wilson than it is now. So that guy was a monster. His administration was monstrous. You couldn't say negative things about the government or you'd be in jail. So, you know, we have been in much worse spots than we are now. But we're definitely in a worse spot now than we were 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So this is some creepy crap. And so, yeah, as a libertarian, I actually had a guy that I really like, and a very smart guy that is in the medical industry. And he kind of called me up and was arguing with me about my position with a caller, or not a caller, a question that we had a couple of weeks ago about a woman that was getting social pressure from her social circle about whether or not she'd gotten the vaccine. And my attitude was, you know, I said, hey, just tell them you got it. The hell with them. In other words, it's really nobody's business. And therefore, I don't feel any moral obligation to say, oh, I haven't gotten it, knowing full well I'm about to get a tidal wave of shit. So my attitude is, no, I'm not interested in having that discussion. And he was upset because being in the medical industry, he felt like that was an irresponsible position. And he felt like essentially I'm not sure where he stands on whether or not you should get the vaccine, but whether or not you tell somebody you've had it, that he was upset about this. Now, we had kind of a heated discussion, and this starts to be this interesting problem that many issues about personal freedom, very often they're not black and white. You wind up on a continuum and it gets complicated, which is why you've got millions and millions of pages of civil and criminal law. In fact, the distinction between civil and criminal law is an odd idea. Like, where exactly does that go? Okay, so if you fake receipts to the IRS, then that's criminal. But if you underreport your income, that's civil. Really? I mean, that's literally what it is. It's arbitrary. But it's not arbitrary when we...
Well, it's how much evil is in your heart, Doug.
Well,
if anyone could know, it would be the IRS.
Well,
yeah,
you know, exactly. This is why the IRS and the Catholic Church, you know what I mean, really should merge, because it's really, you know, in confession, it's about, it's not about what you did, it's about what you thinking.
Exactly. Totally.
So this, so I could see in this discussion how suddenly it turns into a gray area and people can argue, like, okay, well, suppose I'm a nurse and I'm going into a nursing home with a bunch of elderly people and they ask me, have you had the vaccine? And I say, yes, but I haven't had it. Well, now that's interesting. That's a, you know, if that situation exists and if the if documentation isn't required, and is it actually a requirement that you have had the vaccine, but they're not checking and you're lying? Okay, well, that's a somewhat different ethical issue than I'm sitting around a table with half a dozen friends, and now we've got a different discussion, and they've all got the vaccine, and they're all, and I'm smelling the push. Okay, now, And now we wind up with some interesting discussions. It's like, well, if you guys have all had the vaccine, then theoretically, even if I had the virus and hadn't had the vaccine, I couldn't give it to you, right? Which means you can't give it to your grandmother, right? So what business is it of yours? Okay. So now it becomes, well, there's immunocompromised people out there that you could come in contact with. And my attitude is, that's their problem. You know, I'm not the only vector on earth, and therefore it's not my responsibility to be solving this problem. It's my responsibility to be looking at my personal individual issues and trying to make a decision for myself. And if you think that's creepy, I want you to look in the eyes of your 8-year-old daughter and realize that child has zero chance of dying of COVID. And you're gonna give that kid a vaccine? Wow. For whose benefit? And so my attitude is, whoa, this notion that we have a personal responsibility to unknown people in the society who are immunocompromised, i.e., and let me explain why that's an important issue, as was explained to me in this conversation. That my attitude is, if you feel like you need the vaccine, go get it. That's not my problem. So how can I be a problem to you if you've had the vaccine? Shut up. I don't need to hear your opinion about me being irresponsible. You take care of yourself. And then if you're, well, what about the people that didn't get the vaccine? That's not my problem. That's their problem.
Yeah. Okay? I mean, this is the drunk driver argument, right?
Yeah.
That you're, this is, if we're looking at this from sort of a political, yeah, you know, just moral, ethical point of view, that mm-hmm. it's not just your risk analysis. It's your decision, and we've morphed this discussion from one about vaccine passports to one about the vaccine itself.
Yeah.
And these are just to kind of remind folks who are listening, these are separate debates. You know, it's, we can be opposed to one and not the other, and you know, we can have different conversations about these things. But I think it's important to have open conversations about all of these things rather than just stepping into any kind of preordained party line. But I, you know, it is, you will run into that critique very often, that you don't get to make an individual choice for your life and liberty when it has like direct harm potentially on other people who are just wandering into, you know, they through no fault of their own, they're not necessarily choosing to come into contact with you. You're just intermingling in the public sphere.
Yeah, now starts the game, okay? Because the truth of the matter is, supposedly just about every damn person could be vaccinated to their benefit if they choose to. So now we're starting to look at a very tiny slice of humanity, a very tiny slice of humanity who is immunocompromised and therefore cannot make use of the vaccine. Okay, so now I want to know what that number is, okay? Because those are people that theoretically can't be helped. And now I want to ask, how did they get so immunocompromised that they cannot make use of the vaccine? Okay, how much of that was personal responsibility on their part about their diet and lifestyle issues? How many of those people smoke?
Now you're victim blaming. You're going to get us canceled, Doug.
The point is, these are deep libertarian questions. Okay, because the truth is that vaccine to me is a great thing. It's a great opportunity for an individual to choose to do that to themselves if they so choose. I'm not anti-vax. I'm anti-forced vax. It's a whole different issue. Okay.
I'm particularly
with respect to this candy cane virus that we have that isn't even remotely similar to the epidemics that we've seen in the past that were vastly more lethal. So this is a fascinating point in history about the hysteria about this and how much tremendous expense that the society is going to at this point to start talking about this issue. Who the hell is it that's immunocompromised right this second that cannot use the vaccination processes that we have available? Wow. Like, who the hell is it? Who is it that everybody's deciding now, or at least there's a strong political force now, as we start to head towards possibly mandatory vaccines, or at least mandatory vaccines to do anything? Who exactly is it that we're attempting to save? It's not people that are not vaccinated. That isn't who it is. It's people for whom the vaccination process right now can't help them. Why is that? What do they look like? What are the underlying conditions? And so we're all going to like morph our reality around 1/10 of 1/10 of 1% of the population of whatever the hell it is. And who are those people? And where are they living? And what is their behavior if they are one of those individuals that they would be out in a public sphere exposing themselves? I think it would be their responsibility to make sure that they are in a low-risk situation. Okay, so, you know, this is a deep libertarian issue, but, you know, the libertarian position, i.e. that government which governs least governs best, that's being thrown out the window. And an appreciation for the gray area of control and the cost-benefit analysis that every individual should be able to be running on this. This is not bubonic plague. This is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a virus now that if you somebody could tell us, and probably will by the time somebody hears this, somebody can email me the evidence on who the hell is it that can't make use of the vaccination, i.e. immunocompromised, how many of them are in the society, and how the hell did they become immunocompromised? Because if they're 200 pounds overweight, and they have terrible respiratory problems, and they smoke cigarettes, okay, it's like, whoa, you're asking me to vaccinate my child so that that individual who can't make use of this existing vaccine is a little bit safer? The hell with that. I have no interest in that. So anyway, these are the ways that a libertarian thinker, at least this libertarian thinker, and I think many more like me, would think about these issues. So when it comes to the vaccine card so that I can get on an airplane, I mean, I have to shrug my shoulders and say, well, if every airline is going to require that, then I'm going to have to make that decision at some point. But, you know, I'll make that decision on whether or not I ever get on an airplane again behind that. You know, once all of those decisions are made and I've got personally more evidence about the safety of that vaccine. Okay, so, but right now, I don't have jack information that I have any confidence in about the safety of that vaccine. So once again, to anybody that didn't hear this clearly, I am not anti-vaccine. I'm anti-ignorance. Okay, and I don't want to be making decisions under ignorance, which is exactly what I would be doing right now. And anybody who thinks they're not making that decision under ignorance is ignorant. You are making
well because
that
nobody's nobody knows. Because that's not a conversation that is ever being had. I mean, you're not the sort of conversation about who is this group that needs this protection? You know, this mythical group. Like that's third rail stuff that you can't. I mean, anything that would look like that sort of victim blaming immediately gets, you know, pulled under this umbrella of systemic oppression of various groups. And the sort of politics of inequality. And so none of it gets talked about in a very precise way. It all just immediately gets swallowed up by highly charged political discourse.
Yeah.
And so everybody just kind of backs away, mm-hmm. puts their hands up and says, okay, well, let's not go into this really charged territory where it's going to be an unpleasant conversation for everybody involved, and people are going to get their feelings hurt, and people are going to feel personally attacked. It's better just to kind of brush all of that under the rug and have a much more abstract conversation. So, yeah, there's just so many moving parts here, and if private enterprise is required, you know, including airlines, are requiring a specifically proof of vaccination to board the plane, that's one thing, and that's something that I could reckon with, and I would be probably able to come to an equilibrium with where I would feel okay with doing that. Mm-hmm. But it's that's what you do when you fly to many parts of the world. You know, mm-hmm. You got documentation, you're vaccinated against yellow fever or whatever it is. You know, it's sort of like, okay, yes, here's my vaccine, quote unquote, passport, so I can travel to places. That's a very different proposition than an app on your phone that your vaccine status is just part of a catalog of data that app is tracking about your comings and goings in the world, regardless of how safe and how limited in scope they tell you that data is, particularly if that app is a governmental app. It's mm-hmm. like, here is the Department of Homeland Security's, you know, this is the universal pass to participate in public life in the United States. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, part of that is whether you have a little green check mark next to your vaccine status, mm-hmm. but it's also integrating with everything else that you do. I mean, this is the road to something like China's social credit system.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think it is overly hysterical to make that point. I think it's a really important civil libertarian point that needs to be made. If it's going to be made at any point in the course of this debate, it needs to be made now. Yeah. I mean, how do you think these things start? It's already started. We already do have a de facto social credit system, and this would just make it de jure. This makes it actually following you around in the form of an app on your phone that starts to tell civil society whether you're a good citizen or not, and you know what prices you should pay for things, and whether you should get credit extended to you, and all of these things that are subsumed in that kind of system.
Yeah.
So, which of course, I mean, there's already the Biden administration has already come out saying that they are developing better tools for figuring out who is susceptible to false narratives on social media.
Oh God.
And so that gets part of your social credit score. You know, if you're the kind of person who's retweeting misinformation according to the regime, your social credit score goes down and your fewer doors are going to be open to you. So this is all, like, it's all well and good when the side that you like is in power, but this is why you need to keep your eye on the ball of the principle involved. This is high level, high concept civil liberties that we should be worried about, not who is benefiting in the moment at any given time. That's the road to tyranny when you start thinking that way. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, share with people, because they may not have heard it in any detail. You first described this to me like in the last 60 days about China's social credit situation. Mm-hmm. Explain to people mm-hmm. what the hell this is and why you should have your ears perked up when we do anything that remotely resembles it.
Yeah, well, it's just this sort of thing. It's a highly integrated system where China has a deep, deep surveillance state on its own people, where it has actively integrated everything that currently in the U.S., you know, all of these companies and all of these apps and everything that we're doing all day long online and elsewhere is still to some degree disaggregated. So, you know, that all of these companies are not talking to each other. It's not there are avatars of you that exist and that drive algorithms of your behavior, but those are not openly traded back and forth between all actors, and certainly not necessarily with the government. China has brought all of that information under one umbrella. So there is an avatar of you. There is your name, your facial recognition analysis with all of the cameras cameras that are on every street corner and every subway tunnel and every, you can't go anywhere in China without getting your face scanned. And in fact, the way that you pay for goods in most stores now is through facial recognition software. You just like look into the little camera at the register and it brings up your social credit profile, which is a little dossier of your citizenship and things that we would be comfortable with in the West, like your credit history, your credit worthiness, those kinds of things were already sort of, we already trade a fair amount of personal information in exchange for that sort of assigned value, but also, you know, how troublesome are you? What kind of, you know, what are your politics? Who did you vote for? How often do you vote? What kind of neighborhood do you live in? Who are you connected to on social media? What sort of stories have you posted on social media? What are your political leanings? What upsets you? What do you support? All of these kinds of things are linked. They're all tied together, and all of that information is available at the touch of a button, or of a scan of your face. And so this is like some deep dystopian shit.
Yes, it is like, very deep and dystopian.
And it sits out there as this kind of like specter of, oh, well, that's China because they're an authoritarian regime. So, of course, they're doing shit like this, but we would never do anything like this. But we have all of these technologies. They're just not united under one umbrella, and certainly not, by the government, from the government. We move down that road, and I don't see any meaningful distinction between the two systems at that point.
Yeah, well, what's creepy about it, and here's the problem. This is why you know, I mean, obviously any discussion we have is meaningless in the tides of the world. But the reason why it's an interesting one and has a feeling of importance is it's only a one-way ticket. You never go back the other way, people. The chances of them saying, oh, well, Corona wasn't that big a deal now because it turns out that we calculated over the next 3 years that the average length of life lost by the, you know, the one in 1,000 individuals or one in 600 individuals that perished from COVID was about, you know, 6 months of life. So now that we actually calculate the social costs involved with this, it's actually about 1/30th of cigarette smoking. Okay, so actually we made way too big a deal out of this. Tear up your little card. It's bullshit. Everybody, right, plenty of people right. are vaccinated and screw the whole thing.
We're archiving never the gonna app. Happen. We don't need your personal information anymore. Yeah. Like, never mind.
Yeah,
we're
never
shredding
gonna happen.
All the documents.
93 of 2 weeks to slow the spread.
So. Yes.
Yeah, that's depressing.
That's right. So this is why this is chilling stuff. Of that. So Jen, just briefly again, I think you explained to me the social credit score in China, actually, this isn't a theoretical thing. Like, this is actually an open score that people are hustling to make sure that they look like good, compliant little sheep and never say anything against the government. And so it doesn't come up literally a comment on some little social media thing that's being scanned, organized, etc. This is unbelievable. Well, it's what you're looking at is a communist dictatorship that is going to make damn sure that there's no dissidents.
Well, that's why what it emerged from, of course,
yes.
is to keep, you know, monitor the dissidents and or potential dissidents and any kind of discontent with the regime whatsoever. So, I mean, you can't do, I mean, even I haven't been to China in a long time. I think the last time I was there was 15 years ago. But even then, you know, I was in this little hippie hostel and it was you know, early enough that nobody had smartphones or anything. So there was still a bank of computers in the hostel that people could use to send emails home and everything. And the people at the desk of this hostel said, you know, just FYI, nothing that you do on these computers is remotely private. So everything, every keystroke is being logged. Everything is completely being sent right up to the highest levels. Like, there's no concept of personal privacy. So they started started from that premise very, very early on. And as technology has advanced, as AI has improved, they just have every single one of their citizens incredibly well mapped and yeah. incredibly well predicted. And I mean, you're able to maintain any kind of system of power with that sort of information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, incredible. So yeah, I think that once again, you know, I can I look at this with the same feeling of horror that many libertarian thinkers have looked at, you know, across the landscape of America's, you know, existence, and they've seen things that scared them and bothered them, and when we look back in retrospect, you know, it's like it wasn't too great, but it wasn't that bad, and there was a trade-off, and you know, etc. So, and one could make that argument with the vax thing for a God knows COVID. You know, I don't know why that's such a big deal, but I guess it's for everything and everything that exists now and everything to come. With respect to getting on an airplane or I don't know, visiting the DMV. I can see a world where 10 years from now I'm shrugging my shoulders and there wasn't any major clipping of my personal freedom's wings behind that other than just what it is that I'm staring at and the decision that I make, et cetera. So I can, you know, I probably will feel that way, but I feel this creeping, I don't know how many of our listeners have ever watched, you know, much Star Trek, but there was a very creepy, episode in Star Trek: The Next Generation that was beyond belief good. It was sort of I can't imagine that in 48 minutes or however they did this thing, that they so succinctly put together essentially the story of this along with the invasion of the body snatchers. And it was an episode called The Game, and it was when Riker goes, you know, has a frolic with some gal, you know, on some outpost, and she says, "Hey, are you playing the game?" And it's on effectively a cell phone or whatever it is that they're carrying. And he, as soon as he puts maneuvers with his mind, the little wedge into the little slot and it lights up, you see his facial expression. It's very much like somebody that just got drugged. And he's like, "Hey, that's really cool." And she's saying, "Yeah, everybody's playing it." Okay. And then you watch as this spreads through the Enterprise and you watch it take over, and then everybody's staring at screens, everybody's doing their little stuff on there, and you know, there's the great drama is, you know, this thing's going to shit and nobody's paying any attention, and you know, it all gets rescued in the end, and it's incredible, brilliant drama in 48 minutes or however they did that. It's an amazing show. But that, you know, I look at some of that now and it's like, hey, you're looking at a world of supernormal stimuli and everything about your contact with it, as Jen would say, is being recorded. They've got an avatar of you. They're feeding it back to you. I don't kind of like the feeling that kids don't go outside and throw a baseball around anymore. You know, they're looking at a screen. And I don't know, this is an odd looking world as I'm seeing it. And things like this and more essentially government scrutiny, government knowledge of who it is that you are. Also as Jen is concerned about the sort of burgeoning antipathy that goes on as social media feeds back to us our own what it is that we are interested in and who our enemies are. And it sort of swells into a constant, you know, pretty edgy conflict. Kind of, you know, I'm wondering about the day when people actually go out to a Little League game and nobody's worried about anybody else's politics because it doesn't really matter and everything's cool. And, you know, I wonder where we're going.
Yeah. Well, that's the intersection here, is that, you know, we have big tech has demonstrated its willingness to censor self-expression in a very real way.
So, yes.
And we can have a whole big philosophical debate about, you know, where's the line? Where's the line with free speech and free expression from, you know, saying things that are unpleasant or mm-hmm. or even potentially hateful versus mm-hmm. you know, shouting fire in a crowded movie theater.
Right.
There is a line. This is something that American jurisprudence has struggled with mightily mm-hmm. and, you know, come to some kind of conclusions about what constitutes free speech, even speech that may be quite detestable and that mm-hmm. you know, people don't want to hear or are very uncomfortable with is still protected speech. Yeah. Someone who is actively agitating, who is, you know, really trying to mobilize, particularly behind legitimately false information, i.e. fire in a crowded movie theater,
right.
that is not protected speech. But
right.
you get into social media and it's like, well, how do we know? We're in this post-truth, you know, sort yeah. of fake news paradigm where, yeah, at first blush, it looks like some of the people who have been canceled deserve their cancellation, and some of them undoubtedly do, but not all of them do. And so how are we arbitrating what is protected speech and what's not? Well, we've left it to big tech to figure that out for us, big tech and their algorithms.
Yeah.
And now we're having the marriage of big tech and their algorithms with something like a passport that, you know, on the premise of communicating our vaccine status is a gateway to consolidating huge amounts of information about us. Mm-hmm. And, you
social
know, it's
credit.
Being designed by exactly the same kinds of engineers who are building these other systems that are censorship happy. And mm-hmm. so your social credit score, you know, is in China very much linked to your political beliefs, very much linked to, you know, how friendly toward the regime you are and how many of your personal beliefs and the ways that you express them are acceptable or not acceptable. Mm-hmm. And until now, these sorts of ideas were completely protected. And the notion mm-hmm. that we would go after this was just anathema in First Amendment thinking. And it no yeah. longer is. It's become something that we're much more comfortable negotiating in a new way and holding people to a different standard. And I think there are important conversations to have about that, because I'm sympathetic to the idea that, you know, it's not a simple free speech debate when you get something like social media involved, because now you have people who have potential access to megaphones that they wouldn't have had. So the whole idea with free speech is that bad ideas get shot down with better ideas. You know, it's sort of an equitable playing field where everybody's able to have open debate and bad ideas are driven out of the marketplace by better ideas. And that's all a really kind of beautiful John Stuart Mill sort of notion that does to some degree get distorted when you get something like someone on Twitter who has millions of followers who's able to communicate in a way that is disproportionate to the voice that they would have had in an open free speech field. So, you know, through bots, through who else, who knows what else is going on there. There's some complexities to this debate. I don't want to oversimplify it, but
yeah.
we're not even having it at that level. We're just sort of slowly boiling ourselves to death in the water
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
accepting one little intrusion after another intrusion yeah. all. And I just, it's like you know, I used to work for the ACLU before the ACLU became completely corrupted and lost its North Star and completely yeah. abandoned its mission. But years ago I was a volunteer and then an intern and then an employee of the ACLU. And it's the whole idea is that you keep your eye on the notion of free expression over beyond everything else. It just does not matter who's saying it, what they're saying. You protect the detestable speech just like you protect the speech that you like. You have to maintain the principle or you've lost the entire premise of what you're there to do.
Yep. Yeah.
This is amazing. Dr. Hawk, thank you for yeah. your input. Dr. Lyle, thank you for your input as well. I've got a question, which is there a Beat Your Genes theme around this topic that we could kind of look at with everything going on? What would you advise, you know, a listener to do if this is kind of creeping up?
It's interesting.
Kill your internet. Yeah. your computer.
Yeah. Because someone sent me this information about the vaccine passport, and I read it, and I was like, I all started getting worked up. But I've been absent from the political, you know, news for a few months now. So I don't know, you know.
I guess my feeling, which usually in my best interest, is to just be basically ignorant, because the truth of the matter is that any government moves that go on in the world actually go on slowly, and whatever alternative actions that you have, I guess this boils down to a critical principle identified by. I first became aware of it in reading How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World by Harry Brown. It was sort of the libertarian thinker that sits right on top of my own personal philosophical view of the world. And Harry distinguishes between direct and indirect alternatives. And a direct alternative is something that you can do that depends on nobody else. An indirect alternative is something where you have to convince somebody else to do something in order to get what you want. And so these are hugely important concepts to have in your head. And so any given problem in my life, I flash through those two chains, you know, basically alternative chains of events. And I want to know what I'm in control of and what I can do, and therefore, in other words, can I solve this problem? It may be inconvenient to solve it, but can I solve it? As opposed to, if it requires someone else to do something, then I'm not in control. Okay, and now I have to do nothing other than its manipulation or influence. Incidentally, when I generally try to use the word manipulation, I'm trying to have it in its purest sense, which means doesn't mean deception or pressure. It means simply to alter. Okay, so all communication is fundamentally manipulative. In other words, you're attempting to make an impact on the receiver to influence them in some way. That's the only reason that any animal would ever communicate anything. But we could alternatively use the word influence, and that might be feel like it doesn't have quite the pejorative feel to it, but the point of it is that indirect alternatives require you to influence or manipulate other people in order to get what you want. And sometimes very much that's necessary. And that you're in situations where there's no other way for that to happen. So if you're writing an essay to try to get into UC Berkeley, I strongly suggest that you don't write something that has a libertarian flavor, because you're attempting to influence the people on the other side of that. So that essay, you and I all know what that essay should smell like politically. Okay, I just thought I'd take that shot, you know, at the situation here. But the point here is that I'm never too disturbed as I look at the world that we sit in here and in many other places that are very free, full of opportunity, full of fine people of all persuasions and all viewpoints of everything, and talents and looks and interests and everything else under the sun. We get along very well generally with each other here and other places. And the notion of curtailing of our freedoms is irritating and slightly alarming. However, you have a great deal of freedom, and freedom is never by any means essentially infinite. So you, in order to have the benefits of any group living, you have to essentially have some of your behavior, under control of the group's rulemaking strategies, etc. So that's fine. I can live with that. How much openness I would have and what control I would want the government to have, it's not even remotely close to any government that we have on Earth. In other words, I'd have a hell of a lot less control. All kinds of things that the government would be considering illegal and problematic and et cetera, I would never have the government involved. We saw an example of that this week with, I think, Cuomo or New York talking about this card, and the governor of Florida said, never going to happen.
Excelsior pass, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Which, again, if I can just, like, let's go back, you know, if people have watched Wayne's World, if they remember the time travel, like, let's get in the time travel machine and go back to 2004 and imagine George W. Bush holding a press conference saying, we have this new vaccine passport called the Excelsior pass. You know, it's like there were riots in the streets. They'd burn the cities down. Like, leftists would be up in arms. And so the political pivot on this is just fascinating to me to watch how these high principles of civil liberties become politically expedient and situational depending on who's advancing the limits to them.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you. Reminded me of the, like, the name is just so dystopian. I just can't handle
it. Yeah. It's i.e. no integrity to any high principle. And yeah. And so that's so obviously, I mean, I look at this and I'm not particularly worried in the sense that my life is very unlikely to be impacted by almost anything that is going to happen in the next 30 years in with the government of the United States. The government of the United States won't become much more oppressive and problematic than modern day France. I don't believe that. In other words, you just wind up with, you know, increasing government intrusions, increasing government clipping of economic opportunity, increasing government, you know, transfer payments. In other words, that's what you're, and all kinds of other little things. I talked to a guy that wanted to start a shave ice business in Cancun. And he went down there and he said, man, there's just no reason we shouldn't have shave ice down here. It's hot. It's, you know, cheap. It's sugar water. You put it on, you know, ice and you sell it for $4 or $5. This is a winner. And later I talked to him and he said, impossible. You have to get 37 permits to open one stand. It takes like 3 years to get through the permit process. Yeah. It's like, there you go.
Buy everybody off.
That's why everybody's broke and they have an incredibly poor civilization down there and why they're an economic disaster area. It's not because their people are stupid. It's not because they lack natural resources. It's not like they couldn't have a middle class that looks like the United States. No, that's not what it is, people. It's 37 frickin' permits. It's a completely corrupted, complete disastrous of a governmental system. Where one little government bureaucrat after the next and his buddies engineered a bunch of stuff that was somehow advantageous to them for some strange reason. And you wind up basically, you know, battering and bullying this vibrant animal until it's barely alive. And that's what a socialistic European socialism looks like. And so, you know, the U.S. just in general is, you know, has been creeping that direction and it has survived fine. But you just wonder with all of the strong drift to the left and everything that can happen as a result of that, you know, like I said, no big impact to me. And it won't be impacting probably in any big way the upper third of the SES of the society, particularly the people who pay the price are ostensibly the people it is that you're trying to help, which is the people who are at the bottom of the society, which gain the most when an economy is vibrant and people are as free as possible to do the trading that they would do. And that's when you wind up with, you know, 14% unemployment. And think about that. Anyway, it's my rant. I don't even know where it started or why. Oh, I think it's because...
Well, it was the how to beat your genes.
Yeah, I'm not catastrophizing over it. So the beating of the genes is like, hey, understand that you have direct alternatives. You know, you do. I think the William Graham Sumner argument about, you know, A, B, and C with respect to anything, that, you know, the world hailed when A takes money from B and gives it to C, then everybody hails A as the great savior and worries about the plight of C. But what about B? And the answer is B starts pretending to be C. It's real simple. Okay, it's not a problem. That's how it works. So we can, you know, you can always individually maneuver your way around probably almost anything at some degree of cost or you know, personal inconvenience. It's fine. It's not going to be the civilization of the world is going to be wealthier and outstanding in the United States. The future is bright, but boy, when you see horrendously unprincipled, aggressive decision making, that, you know, it's just like I shrug my shoulders and roll my eyes, and I think about basically poverty and curtailing of freedom around the world and the enormous human expense that is derived from these kinds of attitudes. You know, anybody that thinks that you know, that they know better, yes, so did Mao. Okay? And people need to understand an unbelievable fact of reality, that this is one of the most astounding statistics in world history. We actually have good records, because people have been writing for 6,000 years. We have good records about the standard of living in China in the year 1000 AD. Okay. It turns out that under Mao, the average standard of living of the average Chinese person was below what it was 1,000 years earlier. Okay? That's what you get when you let your government take over and control human behavior, etc. So this is why people like myself, when we start hearing about, you know, essentially all the rules that need to be coming and all the crap that we need to impose on people, we shake our heads and realize you are curtailing the potential of human existence. From the Beat Your Genes standpoint, you know, a big part of the Beat Your Genes standpoint is don't take up arms. You know, don't try to go to the government and change anything. Don't waste your life with an indirect alternative. That's a total waste of your time. If you enjoy the process, if you love it, that's one thing. But if it creates a great deal of frustration and anger for you, and a feeling of angst and a feeling of terrible losses that are incurring, and you're on the wrong side of a tidal wave, forget about it. Don't worry about it. The country, this country, and Western democracies are free enough, prosperous enough, and wonderful enough for you to enjoy your existence. Okay? The fact that they don't run the way some of us who know better would run them is just the way it is. Okay, that's okay. It's like a company that does a pretty good job at making whatever it is that they make, and you look at it and you say, you could do an awful lot better job. And it's like, yeah, they could, but they're functioning. It's like, okay. You know, that's such is life. And don't sweat it. Beat Your Genes is, you know, there's no reason. I don't spend a lot of time frustrated, but when Jen starts talking about social credit scores in China, my blood starts to boil.
I mean, I totally get where you're coming from, and I am totally sympathetic to that perspective. I think I also have spent too much time looking at, you know, fairly open, fairly democratic regimes that have flipped alarmingly quickly behind, you know, emergency powers. Like that's uh-huh. It's one of the themes that you see through comparative politics, is that you can have a pretty well consolidated democracy, but, you know, you've always people in power always want more power. That's just sort of how it goes. And if they have the pretense and the pretext to grab it, they will. And we're in sort of an unusual confluence of factors that are making that more possible than it has been in our lifetime. And so that definitely raises the alarm bells for me, just, you know, both from its effect on me personally and my ability to express myself freely and everything that I would be worried about, just at a, you know, optimizing my own life and happiness kind of level, but just also as somebody who has studied political philosophy and cares about small L liberal principles and post enlightenment principles of freedom of expression and assembly and individualism and all of these things that United States was founded on, were, you know, if there's a hill to die on, if you're gonna get yourself agitated, this seems like it should get you a little stirred up. But I'm totally sympathetic to, you know, me going out there raging in the streets is at this point, you know, we're not in the same context that the people who did that in East Germany were in. Even, I mean, the world has really, really changed, and the cost benefit on your, well, at this point, you go out and you protest in the wrong way, it's going to be a real dock on your social credit score. So you got to be careful, right?
Yeah.
So, is Dr. Hawk saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this mask?
Interesting. No, I hear you. Having lived 20 years longer, and my feeling is, I think we're going to be okay. But I also hear you. We could be a whole chunk worse off than I'm anticipating in terms of freedoms. We're not going to be a chunk worse off than I think economically. Economically, we can't help but succeed just because of the nature of human innovation at this point. So that can't really falter, particularly in any substantial way. But what you're talking about, I think, Jen, is you've got my attention, and you've got my eyebrows raised, and it's disturbing because I didn't even really know what the hell canceling was till we started talking. You know, you brought it to my attention maybe a year ago, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. To me, it was way out at the periphery, and now it's like, whoa. You get your. Did you say that something you and I talked about got marked on YouTube as questionable? I think that was.
One of our early discussions on COVID, which you know, has we could argue about how well that stood the test of time and whether we would say things in exactly the same way now that we said them then. I think for my part, I probably would not have. I probably would have adjusted some of the things that, you know, we were a little cavalier in early days. But, you know, we were working with the data that we had at the time and making, I think, you know, we would absolutely stand by the inferences that we made based on that data.
Sure.
And no one else could have made any other inference based on the same data. And so, but yeah, it's marked as, I forget what the, it wasn't banned from YouTube,
right.
But it was marked as misinformation, essentially.
Disgusting.
Which is interesting because it's a historical artifact. It's like, okay, my position has evolved. In order for it to evolve, it had to start somewhere. So you're just going to erase where it started from, and I am only a creature of what I believe in this moment without seeing the entire kind of intellectual and informational legacy and pedigree of how what got me there. Like, isn't that how knowledge builds on itself? Isn't that how we learn from each other? Isn't that what this whole enterprise is supposed to be about? But no, we're losing that because anything in the past that is not a perfected expression of what we believe right now or what our dear leader tells us to believe right now is suspect, and it must be erased. And that is very Maoist. It's not even Soviet, it's Maoist. And, you know, and the other aspects of, I mean, we could go on. This is why I now, you know, we have the weekly show, the Pure Politics show on Hawk Blocked, so we can get into this stuff more, but it's starting to leach into future genes now too. But I am personally having the experience, and I know many people who have, where your politics now, like, this is it's dividing families, you know, that sort of like close friends and family members can no longer talk to each other because of these profound disagreements on principle. And that is something that you didn't, I mean, even, you know, growing up, I had, my grandparents were notorious for saying that they canceled each other's votes out. You know what? My grandmother, very, very liberal. My grandfather, very, very, very conservative.
Yeah, that's
right. And that was just, you know, it was sort of this kind of agree to disagree. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. It wasn't this like, I do not acknowledge, you know, your ability to hold, like, I don't see how you got to your point of view at all. And I think it is completely invalid. Like, that is a completely new aspect in the way that we debate with each other and that we co-occupy space, which leads me to, like, I think you're right that, you know, it's probably no huge catastrophe for most people in terms of their daily experience. But yeah. I think you're going to see more and more, and you're already seeing the emergence of parallel economies, of parallel mm-hmm. spheres, of kind of de facto segregation along race lines, along class mm-hmm. lines, and certainly along ideological lines, where yeah. you're going to have places like Florida and Texas that are,
yes.
you know, doors open, no government intrusion, come on in. And it's you have essentially sub-autonomous enclaves within a federal system like that are pushing the limits of that autonomy,
right.
And what that means at the level of kind of political philosophy, like, what does this mean for the American experiment? Is this, like, without some kind of uniting philosophy to hold the whole thing together, does that spell doom for the whole thing, or can we find a new equilibrium with essentially coexisting states? We certainly couldn't manage mm-hmm. to do that the first time. That
yes.
was not sure. not something that worked for us in our history before. A house divided against itself cannot stand. But, you know, maybe it's different now. Maybe you can have sub-autonomous enclaves that mm-hmm. have very different ideologies, very different economies, mm-hmm. very different rules of civic and civil behavior. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what that looks like or how that functions, but I think that's where we're heading.
Fascinating. Well, Nathan, we didn't get to any questions, but what the heck?
No, that's okay. I mean, this is great to hear you both wind out on this. Yeah, I think, yeah, it's definitely
hilarious.
It's definitely a very charged topic. And, you know, for the listeners, in case we get canceled, you can find Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk at esteemdynamics.com and sign up to the Living Wisdom Library. It's a wonderful website. They have all their, you know, fundamentals of psychology and kind of learning the way of their thinking and this esteem dynamics approach. So, and in case the show gets canceled, you can find us at beatyourgenes.org.
Yeah. It's very good. Very good. Uh-huh.
We'll just host it ourselves.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. We'll just go back
right.
to the fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got
that's
it.
That's right. That's right.
All right.
All right.
Guys, very great talking to the two of you. All cool.
Yeah. Always. Talk to you next time if we're allowed to peacefully assemble.
You got it. All right, everybody.
All right, everybody.
Thanks
good
for
night.
Listening.
Have a good night. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.